That's fundamental. Where can you find, when God said what he did in the Old Covenant, where can you find anything but that you will enjoy life in the land of Canaan till we bury you? There's no promise of eternal life. Your hand will be on the neck of your enemies. You'll have all this, and if you don't obey me, your enemies' hands will be on your neck. No promise of heaven, no promise of a millennium. This is their fundamental flaw. Having assumed that fundamental flaw, everything else follows. Their misinterpretation of Galatians, misinterpretation of Romans. Well, in fact, let's put it plainly, if they hadn't been born into a group teaching what Ellen G. White taught, they wouldn't believe it. But what you learn as a child, you believe. There's no way you can change it until the prophecies are fulfilled. Their time of salvation hasn't come because God hasn't opened their mind. And don't waste time prying it open. Yes.
Are you aware that the Seventh-day Adventists themselves are beginning to have some very deep reservations about Ellen G. White's writings, even to the point of claiming that she plagiarized much of what she purported to write herself from other Protestant authors?
We are in possession of all the published literature on the subject in the News Bureau, and it would not perhaps be correct to say that Adventists are. There are a few among them who have clearly taken that point of view that you've stated, and they are being dutifully booted out of the ministry and out of other functions in the church because the theologians who discovered it are not the administrators who determine who stays in these functional roles of teaching. It is a very significant controversy, and I have alerted all of our Plain Truth and other writers to be aware of this ferment, because Ellen G. White, in fact, got many of these ideas from both the above as well as the earlier around. And the earlier around had previously been influenced by the above. Now there are two aboves. One is of God, and the other is of the devil. Her above was the latter. As proved by her failure to understand the most fundamental of all things that is clear to us from the holy days, which have to do with salvation. Is it
coming? I don't know that much about the Seventh-day Adventists. How did she?
I'm not trying to educate you either. The contrast, the shocking contrast, should enable you to understand why Mr. Armstrong has hit upon certain fundamentals that are so important.
The question I was going to ask is, how did she get so much power in the church at that time?
Because the church, I will stop with this thought, it isn't critical to the big picture, the church at that time had the failure of 1844, and they were casting about for an explanation of why the Messiah didn't come to cleanse the sanctuary and to restore the kingdom. And the people had lost hope in the restoration of the government of God for 1,000 years in Jerusalem. The Church of God, Seventh Day, did not lose such a hope. But she came along with the idea, she had a vision. And the vision was that the sanctuary that was cleansed in 1844 was in heaven. It had been dirty all this time. Christ had not cleansed the sanctuary from A.D. 31 to A.D. 1844, before he got around to doing it. God's throne was in this mess and disarray because of sin. That is, it had nothing to do with it. The prophecy had a connection only with Antiochus Epiphanes and as a type of the man to come. But, you know, they linked the 2300 quote years to the date 457, which it had no connection with at all. You read Daniel 8 and see if it had any connection with the time of Ezra and Artaxerxes. It was already after Alexander destroyed the Persian Empire, and after Alexander was dead and it was divided into the four major parts, that in their latter days someone would arise and the 2300 evenings and mornings would be fulfilled. So it clearly doesn't start that early. It was, in fact, as I gave a Bible study here, 2300 evening and morning sacrifices between 167 from somewhere in September to 25th of Kislev in 164 B.C. We move along here. All right. Yes.
Did her following come from among the churches of God?
Her following came mainly from people who were previously Methodists, which she was, Baptists, and many other Sunday observing people who were interested in William Miller, who began to speak in 1833 on these things. And after 1844, around 1846, I believe, a Seventh-day Baptist woman brought to the Adventists' attention the Sabbath. And as a result, they didn't join with the Seventh-day Baptists. They began to have fellowship with the churches of God. Well, that's not right. They had began to have fellowship with the people in the church of God. There weren't churches of God even. There weren't that many congregations that had disintegrated itself. And there was a division between those who kept the Passover annually and Ellen G. White, who thought it should be like the Methodists, four times a year. And they agreed on the Sabbath, but they didn't agree on that. And they did agree on basically unclean meats, but they didn't agree on what was going to happen when Christ comes back. And they began to get revelations, and she got revelations about the probation, the door of probation being closed. And many of those things have sort of been hidden away in the back closet because, in fact, this is one of the things the Adventists are discovering, that probation has lasted so much longer than it should have. By all the original teachings. And so, in that sense, she had never any major influence among the people who were in the mainstream of the churches of God. These were people who had come among them and had gone out. Similar to the Cathari in the Middle Ages who came among the Waldensians and went out, so the Adventists came among them as prophesied. There would be some in the latter days, like the Cathari, who would deny marriage, and others who would later forbid the eating of meats which God created to be received with thanksgiving of those who know the truth about meats. Adventists officially are vegetarians. That is the heresy that is that Paul prophesied of that should come in the latter days. Yes? Are you asking about what the Bible says on it?
No. Since the Adventists do not believe,
yes,
that they're going to be in millennium, when some people are going to be given opportunity to know about God.
All people, when Christ returns, will either be made immortal or killed.
Some people are going to have opportunity to know about him.
All people by Seventh-day Adventist doctrine are going to either be made immortal or killed, and the earth is going to be empty for 1,000 years.
What about people who didn't have opportunity to hear about his name at all?
Well, now, you're asking about people up to this time.
People before
you. Yes. Well, this is their problem, not mine. In a sense, you see, what they're confronted with is an enigma that all the Christian world has faced, based on the comments I meant that gave to the first questioner. If salvation is not basically open to the world up till a certain time, and even now it is not, because the nations are allowed to go their own way, then we have no problem in understanding the story of the second resurrection, the story of the Feast of Tabernacles, and the eighth day. But what do people do who believe that salvation has been not only open, but required of everybody? The question is, how are you going to get God's Spirit when you don't even know what the word Spirit means? when you're 3, 4, or 5 years old, or when you die at 6 months? And what happens with the little sinner who needed to have his bottom tanned at 3, but it wasn't tanned yet, that's why he was a sinner. He didn't know it was sin, but he was surely sinning, and his attitude was rotten. Is that going to be made immortal, that rotten attitude? These are the problems that these people face. The answer is, of course, there's a time coming. But for them, how are you going to explain what you will do with little children? Now, let's forget about the adult. But little children who have bad attitudes, and you have seen them. Some of them are in the public schools. Sometimes they even got into ours. This is an attitude. They are not conscious fully of the right and the wrong of it, but they know that there is a problem. And they think it's mother and father and everybody else but themselves. That, you see, is one of the difficulties. Because their parents didn't train them, are they permanently lost? These problems have beset theologians for all time because they have never had a way of resolving the real issue of when does salvation come and when does that knowledge come. So the question you pose is really one of the most difficult for the Christian world. It's one of those that the Catholics tried to resolve by having limbus infantum, that is, there is a little place for the infants who, you know, don't make it like the adults, and there was a little place for the patriarchs beside a heaven and a hell and a purgatory, trying to resolve the problem. Yes?
It is mentioned in the prophecies about the Feast of Tabernacles. Do they avoid it completely, or do they try to clarify that at all?
Ellen G. White said, I do not have her work here, an Adventist told me, I looked it up, it is in her works. You can look it up in a concordance to Ellen G. White's work, that she said the Adventist brethren should observe the Feast of Tabernacles. But she just found it didn't go over. So we stopped the quote in Zechariah before now rather than after that section.
But does she allude to the holy days, or what? Did they have any significance at all?
Well, to an extent, she knew the Passover was involved, and she mentions the Feast of Tabernacles. The Adventists, like most Christians, know some connection between the birth of the church and Pentecost. But you see, there is no understanding of what those days mean. Remember, even Herbert Armstrong didn't understand the basic meaning of all the holy days when he first began to observe them. And I have said before that what is fundamental there is you have to, from time to time, decide to observe what God asks you before you know why. And the test as to whether God will give you the information is whether he first has been granted the right by you to have him rule over you and to tell you what to do. Ralph Levy, you ought to be saying something this evening, having been reared in the Jewish community. I couldn't help think of, you know, what must be like to be a Jew and listen to this stuff, especially a converted one from whom the veil has long since been drawn away.
Is there an FDA commentary on the New Testament?
Yes.
I'm just curious, I'd like to get on that one and Romans 11 sometime to see that.
Yes, you would find it. I felt, you know, we use other commentaries and we don't forbid the SDA commentary, but if you really want to understand today why many readers who know something of the Sabbath among them, see. Now, you know, there are other explanations. Baptists have a whole spectrum of various interpretations about these prophecies, some nearer what we say and some not. But this, I thought, was a classic. Simply a classic explanation, especially for people who observe the Sabbath. The Ambassador College Library should have a set of the Seventh-day Adventist commentary. If not, contact me and I will tell you what you could do about it. But I think they should have a set to my knowledge. Is there a question in front here?
Yeah,
yes.
My question is similar to Ralph. What was their explanation for Romans 11 and Revelation 20?
Well, their explanation is in that commentary of Paul's epistles. I do not have it here, and I won't try to. But remember, it all goes back to the premise that you can't understand Romans until you understand that probation...